So grateful to be here, church. Open up God's Word with you, as always. Just an incredible honor and privilege. Kevin, I'm going to turn this mic off. Is that good? It's off? Okay. Very good. It's got a lot of reverb up here, Kevin, so I'm sort of hearing myself. Okay. My wife likes tells me I like to hear myself, but maybe not that much, at least not when I'm preaching, right? Thanks, Kevin. So open your Bibles up to Mark chapter 3, verse 7. Mark chapter 3, verse 7. This text speaks to how easy it is to follow Jesus without actually knowing him. That's a warning. To have shared experiences, events, and emotions with other people, all surrounding the things of God, but have no actual relationship with Jesus Christ. That's a danger. Here we find how you can get swept up into a crowd and confused, disoriented, thinking you are going in the right direction with a common confession in Jesus Christ, witnessing his power and person, you're right in his presence, but really you're carried far away. You couldn't be more distant from him, for you never understood who he truly is and what he wants to do, what he came to do. Simply in this text, we see how the power of the crowd robs Jesus of his rightful authority. Here, we see how one can acknowledge Jesus as God without ever obeying him as Lord. We find this in Mark chapter 3, verse 7. Jesus withdrew to the sea with his disciples, and a great multitude from Galilee followed, and also from Judea and from Jerusalem, and from Idumea, and beyond the Jordan, and the vicinity of Tyre and Sidon, a great number of people heard of all that he was doing and came to him. And he told his disciples that a boat should stand ready for him because of the crowd, so that they would not crowd him. For he had healed many, with the result that all those who had afflictions pressed around him in order to touch him. Whenever the unclean spirits saw him, they would fall down before him and shout, "You are the Son of God." And he earnestly warned them, really rebuked them, not to tell who he was. Today's sermon is titled Mob Spirituality. Mob spirituality. And I know that's a really strange combination of words, right? For when we think of the mob, we often think of unruly people, rebellious group of individuals, a crowd with malicious intent. They're public, they're protesting, they're self-serving, they're unthinking, they're discontent. It's really anarchy. And the opposite is true when we think about spirituality. You think of a person in silent study, a lone individual hidden away in prayer, one man against the world, that sort of thing. Private, personal, other-focused, it's wise, it's peaceful, really it's an ordered life. The first is moved by external factors. The second, compelled by internal convictions. These are words on complete opposite ends of the spectrum. Mob spirituality. Yet despite their antithetical meanings, we find in the time of Jesus, much like today, that people think they can get to God by following the crowd, going with the flow. It's not about a personal relationship with Jesus, but a public demand. We are following Jesus, they say. But it's really a cover, a disguise for an individual to hide what they want in the obscurity of the crowd. Think about it this way. Anonymity allows them to have their own autonomy as they deny Jesus' authority. Really, this is a people who seek God for themselves and what they want him to do for them rather than seeking God for who he is and what he wants to do for himself. That's mob spirituality. And such a response throws true faith and genuine Christian spirituality into utter confusion and complete chaos. It twists God's power towards the devices and desires of fallen men. Worse yet, such a reality leads to false confessions and conversions. People may think they have the real thing when they don't. And we've seen such a thing throughout history. I mean, even before we look at the effect on the church, where we're talking about a real human phenomenon. people are easily led away from the crowd. I mean, many of us know this. It's a powerful force. Here, a mass of individuals can override one's internal personal conviction and cause them to do something contrary to what they really believe. They might conform for a time, but will later think, what was I doing? Or it may impact them for the rest of their life. But it's never a real conviction. This human effect is as old as time. In the late 1800s, it was given a phrase. It was coined by two social psychologists, Gabriel Tarde and Gustave Le Bon. And we know the term well. It's mob mentality. Mob mentality. The term is used to describe how humans blindly follow the crowd and take on different manners, follow trends, and buy merchandise based on their circle of influence. Sometimes it's called a herd mindset or groupthink. This fact has been noted in every area of life, from politics to ethnicity to nation states to interest groups, and has led to protests, looting, war, gang violence, murder, genocide, you name it. Wherever there are people, they want to go their own way and do their own thing, and the crowd is the perfect excuse. It's just the right cover. In short, the mob wants the authority. They are the ones who set the terms, make the final decision, get what they desire. But such a mentality, such a mob mentality, is not just secular. It also extends to the spiritual realm, and that's mob spirituality. Now, some Christians might label such a thing with a different word, maybe one we've often heard in the church. The word is revival. Revival. A lot of people seemingly following Jesus, and that does happen. It happens throughout history. But in reality, more often than not, it's not revival, at least in the biblical sense. It's truly a mob. A large mass following Jesus together without any internal personal heart change. They are just going with the flow, trying to get what they want under the cover of the crowd. And we've seen it in movements just in modern day, past movements like the Vineyard Movement, the Church Growth Movement, the seeker-sensitive or purpose-driven church. We've seen it in political and social crusades, televangelism. It's all about moving a crowd, persuading people, getting them excited, external circumstances, not inward change. And we see the emphasis, right? The emphasis isn't so much on what is said. It's more on coming forward, making a confession, raising your hand. It's not on inward change. It's not on knowing Jesus and seeking to obey his commands. And we've seen this even in recent history with revivals on college campuses. Asbury, just recently, really recently, there was massive crowds being baptized off the coast of California. I don't know if you guys heard about this. 12,000 people were baptized on a single day. When I studied this movement, I looked it up. It's called Baptize California. The pastor who sets it up, he says, according to the article I read, it says he got a vision from God to promote baptism to help the local church. I've never heard that term, promote baptism. Have you guys heard that? I think we're supposed to promote the gospel, and then baptisms come from that, right? We promote the internal heart change, not the external process. But that's hard, because the gospel is not really concrete. It's hard to get people to truly rally around it, but we can, if we say, make a decision, come forward, get baptized. These are all great ways to show your faith. You can see the danger of mob spirituality. Here the power is taken away from God and given to man. It may appear to be the real thing, but it has no lasting benefits. Ultimately, it's dangerous because we're not relying upon him, his dominion, his lordship, but our own, and it opens us up for all kind of attacks and deception. That's mob spirituality, and that's really what we find in our text for today. I want us to look at the crowd, the confusion, and the confession. Here's all we need to determine if we are facing a mob or the real thing. And before we do that, I just want us to remember the background that's surrounding this text. The context is so important. If you remember, as we come to this section in Mark, Jesus has been growing in popularity, right? People are getting to know him more and more from all the surrounding districts. And as he's growing in popularity, so too he's growing in controversy and hostility. He says things the Pharisees do not like to hear, and eventually it all boils over in our previous passage, the one we studied just last week in Mark chapter 2, verse 28. Jesus said to them, "So the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath." That's quite the claim. And then to prove that he's actually talking about himself, he goes into the synagogue in the very next verses on the Sabbath and heals a man, which was against the laws of the Pharisees. And this leads them, in verse 6 of Mark chapter 3, the Pharisees went out and immediately began conspiring with the Herodians against him as to how they might destroy him. The important realization from this text extends in our text for today, and it's simply this. Jesus is Lord of all. He proves it and makes it clear with his miracle. He's master. He has all authority, dominion, and power. There's simply none greater. And as such, his enemies, the Pharisees, oppose him. Right? Every authority needs opposition, right? But the question that we have to ask, and I think we do ask, is what about everybody else? What about the common people? What about you and me? Right, we would expect, under the weight of such obvious authority, right? He says in message, "I am the Son of Man, I am the Lord," and then in miracle he proves it. You would imagine that people would simply just come to him. They would flock to him. But they would come to him in a certain, very specific way. They'd come ready to follow, to obey, slow to speak and quick to listen. "You are Lord, I am your slave." That's kind of the idea that we have. But in our next passage here in Mark, that's not what happens at all. In fact, it's quite the opposite. And this is Mark's classic style. He's always messing with how you think. He's reversing the order of things. Mark pictures Jesus and his disciples, instead of having all power and authority, dominion and rule, now struggling to control an unruly crowd. Here we find the Lord of all, with all dominion and power, abused by many of his alleged followers. They reject his authority and make their own demands, and mocked by his opponents. The demons ridicule his dominion and interrupt his plans. Everyone is pressing what they want onto Jesus, and in the process refusing what he wants. It's an amazing reversal. And as we come to this passage, it's an important lesson for us to hold in our minds, because we so often think, as men, as women, that we have Jesus figured out, don't we? We read the scriptures, we hear that he's Lord, and we think, "Well, I know what to do now. I know how to respond. I have the facts." But what we do is really the opposite. We take our limited understanding of Jesus and move forward, continuing to do our own thing. This text is a warning. It says such a reaction is pride. It's really hubris, for it fails to account for the power of humanity. That's what we discover today. How lurking behind the best intentions is our latent sin nature, only further agitated by other sinners. This context is important. It helps us rightly handle this text for today. For here we see that in the literal presence of Jesus, his indisputable authority, we don't discover increased devotion, but more demands. We don't find greater conviction, but more confusion and chaos. We don't see saving faith, but false confessions. And so let's look at the text now. Let's really dig in. We understand the context. Let's look at the crowd. The crowd. This is in verse 7. Jesus withdrew to the sea with his disciples, and a great multitude from Galilee followed, and also from Judea, and from Jerusalem, and from Idumea, and beyond the Jordan, in the vicinity of Tyre and Sidon. A great number of people heard of all that he was doing and came to him. It starts with Jesus trying to make some sort of escape, right? He withdraws. He's not around the city center anymore. Some translate it as he took refuge. This really speaks to him going to a remote area around the Sea of Galilee. And according to Mark, we don't really know the exact reason he withdrew. In fact, this is the only time this word is used in Mark. In the Gospel of Matthew, it's used more often. Sometimes he withdraws as a strategic technique to avoid the attacks of the Pharisees, to get away with his disciples. Perhaps he can just wants to continue his Galilean ministry, right? He's always interrupted by the Pharisees in the synagogue. Whatever it is, he's followed by a large crowd. And that's really the focus of the section, the crowd. And here we see in the crowd its composition and character. Its composition is straightforward. You see that there is a great multitude. A great multitude. It's going to be repeated twice. Verse 7, a great multitude. Again in verse 8, a great number of people. This means there are a lot of people following Jesus. And we're not talking about hundreds. We're not even talking about thousands. We're talking about many more. There is a lot of people following Jesus. You see this in the word itself. It means great and many. It's a big group. See it repeated in verse 8, as we just said. It's a lot of people, and they're coming from everywhere. I mean, the dispersion of these people and their collection in one spot is really amazing. They're coming from, you can see from this text, they're coming from Galilee, from Judea, from Jerusalem, from Idumea, beyond the Jordan, the vicinity of Tyre and Sidon. There are a lot of people from all over the place. It's quite a list. Especially as we consider Jesus' ministry has really been focused exclusively, for the most part, at least according to the Gospel of Mark, in Galilee. Now, John the Baptist had attracted large crowds, but only from Jerusalem and Judea, and Christ is really breaking the mold here. And then just to give you some context of this geographical area, Idumea is 120 miles due south. Tyre and Sidon are 50 miles to the north. That's quite the span. That's quite the number of people that he is collecting. They're coming from far away, and they're coming to a desolate place. But the composition of the crowd doesn't end with that. Of either greater importance or really surprise is the ethnic diversity. Galilee, Judea, Jerusalem were principally Jewish territories. Idumea and the Transjordan or beyond the Jordan were mixed Jewish-Gentile regions. And Tyre and Sidon were largely, if not entirely, Gentile regions. There are people from all over the place coming to Jesus. And on the surface, this seems like a really good thing, right? People are interested in the things of God, and they're coming from all over, both Jew and Gentile. And that's true, isn't it not? God draws his people from every tribe and tongue. Isaiah 49:6 says, Jesus is a light to the nations. But that's just what's on the surface. What's underneath the surface? Right? You can be fooled by a crowd's external makeup, but you need to know what's in their hearts. What are they thinking? What are their intentions, desires, really? Why did they come? And this reveals their character. And Mark really relates this in classic understatement. Find this in the middle, really the end of verse 8. It says, and from Jerusalem and from Idumea and beyond the Jordan, the vicinity of Tyre and Sidon, a great number of people heard of all that he was doing and came to him. Here, Mark tells us why they came to Jesus, really why they came in mass, why they're traveling to this remote place. It's not for what Jesus is saying. It's not his message, which was abundantly clear. He's preaching day after day. It's for what he's doing. It's for his miracles, for his works. That word in the Greek, poeo, is to make. It describes an act of producing or creating. It's speaking directly to the miracles of Jesus. So the people are there for his works. But if you remember from our study of Mark, even briefly, that's in contrast to what Jesus wants, right? Jesus is not so much about the works. He's about the word. He wants them to hear the message. This has been his single and focused and tireless pursuit. And we see this throughout the Gospel of Mark. I mean, just go to Mark chapter 1, verse 14. Now, after John had been taken into custody, Jesus came into Galilee preaching the gospel of God. John chapter 1, verse 21, they went to Capernaum, and immediately on the Sabbath, he entered the synagogue and began to teach. Verse 38, Mark chapter 1, and he said to them, let us go somewhere else to the towns nearby so that I may preach there also, for that's what I came for. Verse 39, and he went to their synagogues throughout all Galilee, preaching and casting out demons. And people just come, and he keeps preaching and teaching and preaching and teaching. But that's not what this crowd came for. They came for what he is doing. One commentator writes this. He says, Mark is enough of a realist to recognize that it was primarily the hope of physical and spiritual deliverance which motivated the crowds to gather from afar. They're coming to be healed of their maladies. They're coming to have these demons cast out. He continues, he says, they have not come of pure disinterested concern to hear the message of the kingdom of God, but to witness and to benefit from his power in healing and exorcism. That's an unhealthy spirituality. And I'm here for God's work, for my benefit. I really hope he shows up today. I mean, that's a tiring anticipation, isn't it? Hope God works today. If not, I'm in big trouble. And it's also really something that's difficult to accomplish by yourself, isn't it? It's a lonely road to walk, always waiting for God to work. It's exhausting. And so instead, what is it much easier to do? Well, let's get a group of people around me to do the same thing. Affirming, a large affirming group of people who all want God to act according to their best interests too. Here the crowd sustains the energy, not God, and they will assure God is working. Can't you tell? Don't you know? I can feel it. He's moving. He's working. It's his will. I just met somebody a few weeks ago, and they said, I feel like there's a revival in St. Mary's County. And I'm trying to figure out, what are you talking about? I think it's they're building a new parking lot somewhere or something like that. That's mob spirituality. Right, they hijack God's plans for their own purposes, and that's exactly what we find here. People united in a common interest, coming from all over, seeking for God for what he does, and ensuring one another, that's exactly what's happening. In the end, it's not really about God at all, but the consensus. God is working. And right here, we have a clear message. People often overwhelmingly come to God because they want to know what he can do. That's a pragmatic faith. It's built not on the person of Jesus Christ, but what is practical. Here one asks the question, how useful is this God? Can he really work in the ways I've heard? Such thinking is too dangerous. I remember hearing one pastor present the gospel to somebody, and at the end he says, hey, listen, just try it for a week. If it doesn't work out, you don't have to believe. It's like he's selling a car or something. You know, if you don't like it, then come back. You can exchange it for something else. That's not saving faith. Because why? Whether it works for you or not doesn't change the fact that he is the Lord of all the universe, the creator of heaven and earth. That's not saving faith. Coming to God for what he does, not for who he is. Now, you might say, well, come on, God's work is important, isn't it? Yes, it is important. God's work, his promises, they need to be fulfilled. That's true. But you can't get it mixed up, or you can't put one before the other. I mean, just imagine, you know, you turn to your wife, you say, sweetheart, I'm only here because of what you do, not who you are. That's a great relationship, isn't it? But we do that with God, don't we? Say, God, I'm really here for what you do for me, not who you are. You better show up today. That's no relationship. It's really abuse. Christians say if it works, God must be in it. It's a totally backwards way of thinking. It puts the cart before the horse. Instead, true faith must start with seeking the person of God. And he will change you. Don't worry. He will show up. But first, we need to look at him for who he is. It's not dictated by us. Yet the modern church has lost this, isn't it? The modern church starts with pragmatics, starts with what's practical, what's personal, what's purposeful. These are all catchwords in most churches, and admittedly it draws people in, especially in our world, but it doesn't save because Christ isn't at the center of it. I was just talking, we have a leadership and doctrine class that meets here every week. We're trying to raise up godly men in the church for leadership. And we were just talking about this, you know, if you were to go to a Christian, you know, at a seeker-sensitive church or one of these purpose-driven churches. And if you were to ask them really what it means to have faith in the gospel, and you'd probably hear answers like this, well, I believe in the gospel because it gives meaning to my life. It meets my certain needs, right? When I came to Christ, I made a career switch and I was really successful. I have a better relationship with my girlfriend. I got off drugs. I feel at peace. But rarely do people say, when you say, why do you have faith in the gospel? Rarely do they say, you know, it's because I get to know God. I see his face. I know his love, his mercy, his kindness. That's what I've been saved to. And you know, this God of amazing love and mercy and kindness, he's died for me. He's justified me. Romans 5:1 says that very fact. We've been justified by faith in Jesus Christ. This means we were counted as sinners, we were going to be judged, sent to hell, but instead Christ has died for us and we go to heaven. That's why you believe. That's why we praise his name. That's why we're here. It's all about God and what he has done. You get this so twisted. I mean, just imagine, you know, the French Revolution, you got the guillotine over your head. Somebody rescues you from the guillotine. And he says, you know, what did you discover being rescued from the guillotine? And they say, well, you know what? I really feel more at peace. I really feel like I have a more purposeful life now. I have a better relationship with my girlfriend. No, you've been rescued from the guillotine. Your head was going to be chopped off. You have eternal life with God. That's the picture. It's who he is. Church, that's why we need to seek him. That's why we need to be seeking him. But the trouble doesn't stop there. You know, it's so insidious how this works, right? What happens is first you go to God, you're going, I wonder what God can do. And then what does the question turn into very quickly? I wonder what God can do for me. Right? Seems innocent enough. What can God do? But then we start to ask, what can God do for me? And this takes us to our next point. We're moving from the crowd to the confusion. And you see this in Mark chapter 3, verses 9 and 10. And he told his disciples that a boat should stand ready for him because of the crowd so that they would not crowd him. And he healed many, with the result that all those who had affliction pressed around him in order to touch him. You know, a wrong-headed and selfish pursuit of God can throw everyone and everything into confusion. Not just the crowds, but also the committed. Also the committed. It can put the disciples into a tailspin. We see both groups here. You see the committed, and you see the crowd, and you see how they're both really confused. You see this committed in this word disciples. Verse 9, and he told his, and this is important, right? People say, well, I was at such and such an event, and such a thing happened, and I really came to faith, right? Well, God can always work. He works in every situation. There's always committed people wherever Christ is. He can work despite the circumstances. We see this in the word disciples. See this in the word disciples. That word in the Greek is matheteis. It's one who engages in learning through instruction from another. Its fundamental meaning is one who seeks to learn from another. The disciple is not only a partaker of information, but also one who seeks to become like his or her teacher. That's the picture that we have here. So the focus of this term is learning, instruction for greater growth and self-change. You become like your teacher. That's good. I mean, these people are on the same page with Jesus. He is a preacher, and they've come to listen. Better yet, they're trying to conform their lives to the life of Jesus, not so much concerned about what they want, it's not even considered, or their purpose, it doesn't matter. Rather, it's about looking after Christ and imitating him. You find this statement made even clearer at the end of Mark. Mark chapter 3, verse 33, he really describes what a disciple is. Answering them, he said, who are my mother and my brothers? Looking about at those who were sitting around him, he said, behold, my mother and my brothers. Whoever does the will of God, he is my brother and sister and mother. That's a disciple. A disciple learns the will of God and does it. And it's polar opposite from the crowd. Mark wants to make that distinction, but the crowd is pressing in. You see it twice, actually, in verse 9. Because of the crowd, so that they would not crowd him. It's used as a noun and a verb. It's actually a different word from what's used in the preceding or the preceding verses. This word crowd is oklos. Denotes a crowd of people closely pressed together. So the great multitude is talking about many, many people, but here the crowd, it's packed together. We would call it a mob, right? Or a mass, a horde. It's not altogether a positive connotation. And this crowd is crowding. I mean, That makes sense, right? That's what crowds do. They crowd. It has a wide range of meanings. It can mean to crush, to oppress, to compress, to trouble. That's the picture. A lot of people tightly bunched together, all pressing forward at a single point, and it's aimed at Jesus. And these poor disciples, right? These poor disciples, they've signed on to be learners. They're kind of in the remote region of Galilee with Jesus, and now they're surrounded by people pressed at every side. It had to be overwhelming. And he takes them and he kind of recommissions them for a moment for crowd control. He says, get the boat ready. Get the boat ready for an escape. See this, verse 9? And he told his disciples that the boat should stand ready. The boat should stand ready. We're going to see that these disciples actually fail to get the boat ready. Jesus clearly needs it, but it never comes. Later, they're going to get the pattern down. Mark chapter 4, verse 1. We're going to find that he's going to teach again by the sea, and he's going to get into the boat. But here, he never gets into the boat. He just says, please get me the boat, but they fail on this point. But there's a greater failure that happens, and it's really in the context of this confusion, and it's this. We don't find the disciples learning amidst this chaos. They not only fail to do what Jesus asked them to do, but they're also not being informed. They're not growing in knowledge. Their purpose is confused. They're not really fixing their eyes on Jesus. Instead, they're fixing their eyes on this boat. Got to make sure this boat is ready for him. Where's the boat? Let's go find it. This word is used only one time in Mark, proskartero. It means to stick by or to be close at hand, attach oneself to, wait on, be faithful. It can mean literally to go towards with steadfast strength. Only time this word is used in Mark, but it's interesting because if you find it throughout other parts of the New Testament, it often refers to one persisting in their devotion to God's will. See, they're taken off the main objective. Their eyes not on the ball. This word has another meaning. It can be persist in something, busy oneself with, be devoted to. It's talking about a single focus. We find this same word used in Acts chapter 2, verse 41, right after the people come to Christ and hear Peter's gospel message. Listen to this. So then those who had received his word were baptized, and that day there were added about 3,000 souls, and they were continually devoting themselves to the apostles' teaching. Same word. Continually devoting themselves. Paul says it again in Colossians 4, 2 about another spiritual discipline. He says, devote yourselves to prayer. You see how easily the crowd can throw off even the committed, start majoring on the minors. They fail in their service and in their learning. And we see this in the modern church. And I don't know if you've ever had this experience, but in my time in the church, you know, if people show the smallest interest, they come in, they show the smallest interest, they bring a Bible, they take notes on a Sunday service, what does the leadership of the church start to say? Hey, can you lead a Bible study? Right? We need another deacon or elder in our church. Right? We need a youth pastor. Can you preach? What about missions? Maybe you'll be a missionary. Get him in the battle. But they're not ready. They're not really a disciple. They're not focused. They don't have the foundation. Perhaps that is the greatest problem with this mob spirituality, is to feed the crowd, they malnourish the disciples. They don't learn. They don't grow. They don't benefit. But that's the number one task of the church. Ephesians chapter 4, verse 11, and he gave some as apostles and some as prophets and some as evangelists and some as pastors and teachers for the equipping of the saints for the work of service, for the building up of the body of Christ. You know, I just met someone this week, actually. Came here, they wanted some questions, they had some Bible questions, sat down, it was a great conversation. And the questions were just the fundamentals of the faith. What's the Trinity? Who is Jesus? And we started talking more, and I'm going to all these other big box churches, and I get really confused. At the door, they told me, you know, it seems like they're preaching more for the crowd than for those who believe in Jesus. But at your church, it seems like you're preaching more for the believers than for the crowd. Wow, isn't that incredible discernment? That makes a huge difference, because that's what the church really is. We can't get confused. We can't take our eye off the ball. It's about knowing and growing in Jesus. This doesn't mean we don't do anything. It means what we know and grow, it fosters and flourishes in our hearts, and it flowers into service, but it's based in something that's real. But the confusion is not just with the believers, the committed. It's also with the crowd. See this in verse 10. For he had healed many, with the result that all those who had afflictions pressed around him in order to touch him. Again, we see the crowd is crowding him. Doesn't seem like it could get much worse, but it does. And here we have mob spirituality in really all its glory. Christ the Lord is simply not recognized. The respect, honor, obedience, and submission that he deserves is not granted. He wants some space. He wants to preach, but the people are on top of him. And we see this shift, really, this power of the crowd, and the individual is moving from asking, what can God, to what God can do for me in an incredible way. They really want healing. You see that? And in verse 8, it says the people heard of all that he was doing. That's why they first came. But now in verse 10, we see that those who had afflictions pressed around him. It's not so much about what he's going to do, but what can he do for me? We really see this highlighted, this sad reality highlighted in this word for pressed. And we can see it in the scene itself, right? The people want what they want. But really highlighted in this word for pressed. Afflictions pressed around him in order to touch them. You know, it's not uncommon for Jesus to be in crowds, for Jesus to be pressed upon. That's normal. I actually see this later in Mark chapter 5, verse 24. He's going to be in another crowd where a woman is going to reach out and touch him. Mark chapter 5, verse 24. And he went off with him, and a large crowd was following him and pressing in on him. See this same word used again. In the English, it's the same word, but in the Greek, it's actually a different word than what we find here. The word in Mark chapter 5, verse 24, really speaks to a typical crowd. You could say they narrow his path, they compress his way. Anybody who's ever been in a crowd has experienced that, right? You kind of got to work yourself through the crowd. It's narrow. They're pressing against you. You're bumping into people. But here in Mark chapter 3, there's another word that's used. It's epipto. Epi means to be upon. And pipto means to fall upon. This isn't just a pressing. They're falling upon Jesus. The word itself is to cause pressure by pushing against or falling on. Other translations say to fall upon, attack, assail. It's to fall upon with the implication of damage. There's some weight behind this pressing. There's intention behind this pressing. Now, sometimes the word can be used for an embrace, an intimate hug, but that's not what you have here. That's between two individuals. Instead, you have person after person throwing themselves on Christ with no apparent concern for his safety. It's not good. It's actually selfish. And don't get me wrong, right? You should throw yourself at Christ, but not on Christ. You're going to hurt him. That's the picture that we have here. Throwing yourself at Christ recognizes his authority. The second seeks to deny it. You just want to smother him with your needs instead of stepping back to understand who he is and what he wants you to do. You got to give him some space. He's the creator of the world. Get to know him for who he is. Don't just throw on him all that you want him to do. That's the mob. That's the crowd. It prevents Jesus from teaching. It stops him from doing what he wants so they can get what he wants. And the application is clear. I mean, for the committed, are you lost in the chaos and confusion of the crowd to really be focused on Christ? And under the crowd, I mean, it's life, right? Everywhere we are challenged to remove our focus from looking at Jesus and to take care of immediate important needs. But there's nothing more urgent and important than following Christ. And for those in the crowd, right, are you seeking after Christ for who he is or for who you want him to be? Are you looking to Jesus for what he does or what you want him to do? So far, we've looked at the crowd, the confusion. Now let's look at the confession. The confession. And what makes this section very difficult. Right? This is a really interesting section in the Gospel of Mark. Some people just say, this is just a summary of all Jesus went through. Well, thanks. How are you going to preach a summary? Well, this is just a long summary. It's more than a summary. It's giving us a message. But it does seem a little strange, doesn't it? You got the press of the crowd. You got their demands. They're throwing themselves on Jesus. There's confusion. There's chaos. But it ends with a confession. So naturally, as we read this, we think, well, it can't be all that bad, right? There's a confession, at least, at the end. At least the truth is proclaimed, but there is a problem. For the confession doesn't come from Jesus or from his committed followers. Instead, it comes from a representative of the crowd. It comes not from person, actually. It comes from a demon or many demons. This is really a satanic mockery of the situation and challenge to Jesus. We can even see this in Jesus' response. But let's take a look. Mark chapter 3, verses 11 and 12. Whenever the unclean spirits saw him, they would fall down before him and shout, "You are the Son of God." And he earnestly warned them not to tell who he was. Before we really look at the details, some of the details in this, I just want to make three observations, just three notes. The first is that this is not your typical exorcism, right? Typically, an exorcism has the possessed, the demon, the exorcist, and the exorcism. But all you have here is the demon itself. So he's the main focus. He's the main focus of what he says. Second, this is happening again and again and again. That's the scene that's unfolding. Those words fall down and shout, they're both in the imperfect tense in the Greek, which is indicating an ongoing scene. Some translators actually translate this as the spirits, the unclean ones, as often as they set eyes on him, kept on falling down before him and kept on crying out with a loud voice. So they kept on falling, they kept on screaming. It's an amazing experience amidst everything else that's happening. Right, if Jesus doesn't have people falling on his head, he's got demons falling on his feet. But it's not to be confused with real worship, right? These demons aren't worshiping him. Because Jesus is not pleased. Right, verse 12, he's earnestly warned them or rebukes them. He says, stop this from happening. Stop what you're doing. But demon after demon comes and it continues time after time, interrupting what Jesus is doing, deceiving the crowd. Third observation is this. This is not a good thing for Jesus. That's why he warns them. But the bigger question is why? Why does Jesus rebuke these demons? Why does he say, don't say who I am? Why would he not want a confession of him as the Son of God? Now, commentators give a variety of reasons for this call to silence, but in the context, I think there's one that really rises above the others, and it's this. What the demon says is not a real confession. Now, I know that's not groundbreaking, right? A demon, it's not a real, he's not actually a believer, right? It's a lie. That's how the devil works. John 8:44, Jesus says this about the devil and his demons. He says he was a murderer from the beginning and he does not stand in the truth because there's no truth in him. Whenever he speaks a lie, he speaks from his own nature, for he's a liar and a father of lies. A demon's a liar. But this is also a greater reality, right? This demon is a representative of the crowd. He speaks about them too. The demon is presented here as an example, a representative of the people. He is confessing Jesus, saying he is God. That's true. That's a reality. It's something you really can't deny. But there's also something that he's not saying. And this is important. And as I was studying this out and really thinking about the greater context, I started to look at all the different times the demons talked in the scriptures. Talk about a really uplifting study, right? I'm going to study all the different times the demons talked. And I looked throughout the scripture and I found that really in Mark we find a great summary of these statements. You see the first demon talk, Mark chapter 1, verse 23. I want to just look at these statements. There's one in Mark 1, there's one in our text, and then there's another in Mark 5. Mark chapter 1, verse 23. Just then there was a man in their synagogue with an unclean spirit, and he cried out saying, "What business do we have with each other, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." It's the first time a demon speaks in Mark, the second time is in our text, and then we find it again in Mark chapter 5. Mark chapter 5, verse 2. When Jesus got out of the boat, immediately a man from the tombs with an unclean spirit met him. And he had his dwelling among the tombs, and no one was able to bind him anymore, even with a chain. Because he had often been bound with shackles and chains, and the chains had been torn apart by him, and the shackles broken in pieces, and no one was strong enough to subdue him. Constantly, day and night, he was screaming among the tombs and in the mountains, gnashing himself with stones. Seeing Jesus from a distance, he ran up and bowed down before him, and shouting with a loud voice, he said, "What business do we have with each other, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I implore you by God not to torment me." Very similar exchanges throughout the other Gospels when the demons speak. And now if you look at all those responses, you notice something. There's definitely some similarities or some differences. Maybe it's better to ask what you don't notice, actually. What is missing from all these addresses? It's one title in particular. At the demons, they'll call Jesus, Jesus of Nazareth, the Son of God, the Son of the Most High, the Holy One. But there's one title the demons never call Jesus, and it's Lord. They never call him Lord. But that is exactly what Jesus wants them to say right now. Remember, the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. The people can't yet rightly know him as the Son of God, right? He must first die for his people on the cross, give his life there. In fact, that's really the first time, the only time it comes from the mouth of a man in the gospel after his death from the centurion in Mark chapter 15, verse 39. But for now, the people must simply follow him as Lord. They can't understand him perfectly, but they have all they need. He is the creator and power of all things. He is in control. He will do according to his will. But by nature, the demons cannot submit to him in this way. They may know his will, but they can never do it because they have another Lord, and that's Satan. Mark calls him the ruler of the demons. So the irony is thick here, isn't it? Demon after demon comes to Jesus. They fall down before him and say, "You are the Son of God." But what is understood is that these demons will never, never willingly come under the authority of Jesus Christ. They might be forced to submit, but there is no willing obedience. You could say there's no genuine, heartfelt allegiance to his authority. It's not according to their nature. It's impossible. Each demon is Christ's enemy. They want his plans to fail so their purposes can succeed. Amidst the chaos and confusion, they see confessing him as their best option. That's the definition of a false conversion, a false confession. And it represents the hearts of so many within the crowd. James summarizes this well. James chapter 2, verse 17, he says, "Even so, faith, if it has no works, is dead, being by itself. But someone may well say, 'You have faith and I have works. Show me your faith without the works and I will show you my faith by my works.'" And he writes this, "You believe that God is one? You do well. The demons also believe and shudder." That's a warning. It's saying you can believe in God. You can confess him as the Son of God. But are you willing to submit to him as Lord? Here someone says, "I'll call you God, but never Lord. As long as you give me what I want, I'll follow you. But as soon as you demand something more, I'm out of here. If you fail to deliver, then I'm going to be down, depressed, heartbroken, and ultimately walk away." Now, too many churches have come to Christ with this thinking. Too many Christians have come to Christ with this thinking. And if they don't walk away, well, they'll live a very sad life, always waiting on God to do instead of simply obeying him amidst the trials. This really speaks to the bigger picture that we're all in. The desire of our flesh to try and put God in a place he doesn't belong. That's mob spirituality. Such an assembly has the flavor of the religious, but really it's inspired by the very pits of hell. It's a crowd who press their demands upon Jesus as they confess his name, but deny his authority. It claims Jesus, but it's all orchestrated by Satan. And it won't take you to heaven. It can't save you. Instead, you'll find it sending you to hell with Jesus' name in your mouth. That is a really dangerous place to be. That is a really dangerous place to be. And as we see this crowd develop throughout the Gospel of Mark, we see that their greatest contention with Jesus is that he wants control. He wants authority. He wants to reign and rule as Lord and as King. So as we conclude, I want you to go to Mark chapter 15. Mark chapter 15. Very interesting exchange. The same crowd that throws themselves upon Jesus, confesses him as the Son of God, will not acknowledge him as king. Instead, they call out to crucify him. That's mob spirituality. It turns on a dime. Mark chapter 15, verse 1. Early in the morning, the chief priests with the elders and scribes and the whole council immediately held a consultation, and binding Jesus, they led him away and delivered him to Pilate. Pilate questioned him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And he answered him, "It is as you say." The chief priests began to accuse him harshly. Then Pilate questioned him again, saying, "Do you not answer? See how many charges they bring against you?" But Jesus made no further answer, so Pilate was amazed. It's all about his authority, isn't it? Is he the king or not? What do the people do when they hear this? Verse 6. Now at the feast, he used to release for them any one prisoner whom they requested. The man named Barabbas had been imprisoned with the insurrectionists who had committed murder in the insurrection. The crowd, there they are, went up and began asking him to do as he had been accustomed to do for them. Pilate answered them, saying, "Do you want me to release for you the king of the Jews?" Interesting, isn't it? They go to Pilate, who is in authority. They say, "Hey, Pilate, buddy, hey, good buddy, can you do for me what I would like?" And he's willing, because we don't want to follow this king, because he doesn't give us what we want. Verse 9, Pilate answered them, saying, "Do you want me to release for you the king of the Jews?" For he was aware that the chief priests had handed him over because of envy. But the chief priests stirred up the crowd to ask him to release Barabbas for them instead. Answering again, Pilate said to them, "Then what shall I do with him who you call king of the Jews?" They shouted back, "Crucify him." But Pilate said, "What evil has he done?" But they shouted all the more, "Crucify him." Wishing to satisfy the crowd, Pilate released Barabbas for them. And after having Jesus scourged, he handed him over to be crucified. The question of real saving faith, of how to have a relationship with God, of how to stand firmly convicted and establish in the truth amidst trials and temptations, is how you acknowledge Jesus Christ as Lord, how you're obedient to him. This brings